is State of Nevada versus the Taki T. Walker, number 61132. Are counsel ready to proceed? All right, Mr. Cole, go ahead, sir. How are you this morning?
Good, thank you. May it please the court, my name is Michael Kovac. I'm here for the Attorney General's Office, representing the State of Nevada. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I'm here today to ask this court to either vacate or reverse an order of the district court which granted an order to dismiss a single count of a multi-count information. Specifically, it was count number 3. The count at issue charged the defendant with injuring or tampering with a vehicle in violation of NRS 205.274. The order was entered at the close of the state's case in chief in the middle of a jury trial. The primary issue before the court today is whether the double jeopardy clause bars review of that order. There are 3 points I'd like to make. Point number one is that the district court's order constitutes an order of dismissal based on a perceived deficiency in the state's pleading, as opposed to an order of acquittal based on a perceived deficiency in the evidence that the state presented at trial. Point number two, in the event this court agrees with the state's characterization of the district court's order as an order of dismissal, there's simply no authority that supports the conclusion that the double jeopardy clause bars review of that order. This court's decision in State v. Combs is inapplicable. That case only applies to orders of acquittal, not orders of dismissal. In the event this court disagrees with the state's characterization and instead characterizes the order as an order of acquittal, cases decided subsequent to United States v. Combs, specifically U.S. Supreme Court cases decided subsequently, have made clear that United States v. Combs was incorrectly decided. The double jeopardy clause does not bar review of an order of acquittal that lacks the authority to enter that order. With respect to the first point, the character of the district court's order, at trial neither defense counsel nor the trial court expressly indicated whether they were addressing the sufficiency of the state's pleading or the sufficiency of the state's evidence. At the close of the state's case in chief, defense counsel requested either a directed verdict or an advisory jury instruction. Directed verdicts do not exist in criminal trials. In support of that argument, defense counsel argued that the state's theory was deficient. Defense counsel argued that the defendant could not be charged with injuring or tampering her own vehicle. These arguments go to the state's pleading. They have nothing to do with the state's evidence. At no point during the argument did defense counsel mention the state's evidence in any way, shape, or form. Similarly, when the district court granted that motion, it did not mention the state's evidence in any way, shape, or form. Instead, the trial court stated that it was relying on a statute that defense counsel did not cite, and it granted the motion to dismiss. It should be noted that under NRS 174.085, the district court does have the authority to enter an order of dismissal based on a perceived deficiency in the state's pleading. However, in State v. Combs, this court has made clear that the trial court does not have the authority to enter an order of acquittal. In Nevada, trial judges are presumed to know the law and to apply it when making their decisions. If we're going to make that presumption in this case, we would presume that the trial court dismissed the count at issue because it was not sufficiently pled, not because it was a deficiency in the evidence. That brings me to point number two, which I can make very quickly. In the event this court agrees with the state's characterization of the district court's order, there is simply no authority that would support the conclusion that the double jeopardy clause bars review of that order. In State v. Combs, this court addressed the applicability of the double jeopardy clause with respect to order of acquittals. That decision had nothing to do with orders of dismissal. Moreover, in the case of Lee v. United States, it's a case I cited extensively through my brief. The U.S. Supreme Court made clear that the double jeopardy clause does not bar review of an order of dismissal based on a deficiency in the evidence. With respect to point number three, that the double jeopardy clause does not bar review of an order of acquittal entered by a court that lacks the authority to enter, I think it's important to briefly discuss the underlying purpose of the double jeopardy clause. The clause is in place to prevent government oppression. The United States Supreme Court has repeatedly stated that the clause is in place to prevent the government from using all of its power and resources to make repeated attempts to convict an individual. Review of the district court's order in this case clearly would not result in any kind of oppression. If this court concludes that the district court's order constitutes an order of acquittal, it follows that the defense requested that order of acquittal. Given this court's decision in State v. Combs, at that time, defense counsel knew or should have known that the district court lacked the authority to enter that order of acquittal. With those thoughts in mind, I turn to the case law. In State v. Combs, as I said, this court clearly stated that the double jeopardy clause requires review of an order of acquittal, no matter how mistaken the district court was in entering that order. This conclusion was consistent with some general statements that the United States Supreme Court made in double jeopardy cases that preceded State v. Combs. However, subsequent to State v. Combs, the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear that those general statements do not apply in jurisdictions such as Nevada, where a trial court lacks the authority to enter an order of acquittal. Beginning in 2004, with the case of Smith v. Massachusetts, the U.S. Supreme Court made clear that states were perfectly capable of preventing the type of situation we have here, where a trial court enters an order of acquittal in error. By way of example, in that case, the court stated that states were perfectly capable of rendering mid-trial acquittals non-final. The court went further, and more importantly, in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court specifically cited Nevada law and stated that at least one court has precluded the ability of a trial court to enter acquittals altogether. Just this past year, the U.S. Supreme Court went even further in the case of Evans v. Michigan. In that case, the U.S. Supreme Court made absolutely clear that the applicability of the double jeopardy clause turned on whether a state vested its trial courts with the authority to enter an order of acquittal. In that case, the state of Michigan argued that using the double jeopardy clause to bar review of a legal error prevented the state from having a full and fair opportunity to present its case to the jury while the defendant reaps the windfall of the unreviewable error. In rejecting that argument, the U.S. Supreme Court said that states are perfectly capable of preventing that type of situation. By way of example, in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court stated that states can make mid-trial acquittals subject to expedited interlocutory appeals. But again, and more importantly, the court went even further and expressly cited Nevada law, stating that nothing obligates a jurisdiction to afford its trial courts with the authority to enter a mid-trial acquittal. The importance of the trial court's authority can best be seen by taking a look at the sentence that immediately precedes the holding of Evans v. Michigan. In that sentence, the U.S. Supreme Court states that having vested its trial court with the authority to enter a mid-trial acquittal, jurisdictions then bear the corresponding risk that some of those orders of acquittal will be entered in error. Now, taking into consideration the statements in Evans v. Michigan and Smith v. Massachusetts, it is clear that Nevada, by not granting trial courts the authority to enter mid-trial acquittals, have protected the state from the corresponding risk that some of those orders will be entered in error. The bottom line is that the double jeopardy clause does not bar review of an order of acquittal that is entered by a court that lacks the authority to enter it. This would be especially true when the defense requests the entry of that order. The double jeopardy clause is not in place to simply give the defense a tool to prevent a lawful disposition on a charge. It's in place to prevent government oppression. In this case, review of the district court's order will not result in any type of oppression. Unless the court has any questions, that will conclude my argument.
Any questions? All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Cooper. Good morning, Ms. Doyle.
Good morning. May it please the court. Patricia Doyle from the Clark County Public Defender's Office on behalf of Ms. Walker. We are the respondent in this case. This first thing I want to address is whether or not this was a procedural dismissal or a substantive acquittal. This was a substantive acquittal. It was clear to everyone in the court that day. The state has cited to both Evans and Lee for the position that this was a procedural dismissal. However, when you look at the facts of both Evans and Lee, it actually lends support to the defense's position. In Evans, The motion to dismiss wasn't made until after the state had rested its case. The same thing happened here. The defense did not make a motion to dismiss any count until after the state had rested its case, based on the evidence that the state had presented. And we, in the contrary, the defense had made it after opening argument.
So what authority does the judge have to do this? I mean, I've been around here since 1970, and judges don't have authority to do what this judge did.
And I agree with Your Honor.
Why would you let it happen? In other words, if I was in there, I'd say, wait a minute, judge, you can't do this. The defendant would probably go berserk, but the judge can't do this. There's advisory verdicts here, which is incredibly unused, but there's no authority for a judge to do this. So how do we handle this?
Well, Your Honor, to be fair, at the time of the incident, the defense counsel did stand up and initially ask for a directive verdict, but then quickly corrected itself in saying advisory jury instruction. The state then pointed out to the court, Judge, there is no such thing as an directive verdict here. Judge Gates had already made his ruling that he was going to follow a directive verdict. The way to stop this is through the legislature. I agree with the United States Supreme Court that the states are not powerless. I agree that the states do have the power to try to stop this type of situation, but you do it through the legislature. You do it through the statute. In citing the statute 175.381, that only addresses the court's ability to grant an advisory jury instruction and hold the advisory jury instruction to be non-final. That statute does not deal with the idea that when a court goes against that and grants a directive verdict. The legislator can clearly make any errors on the part of a court to be non-final. As it stands right now, directive verdicts, black letter law says that directive verdicts implicate the double jeopardy standard. There's one clear exception. The only exception to that is when the legislator says that it does not. The legislator has not addressed this issue. The legislator has only addressed advisory jury instructions and said that is non-final. The legislator has not addressed when the court goes ahead and entertains a directive verdict. So that's more of an issue for the legislator. Even when you look at the Smith case, it deals with the fact that sovereignties can address this issue. Sovereignties can control that issue. That's what the legislator should control. The legislator has not addressed this issue. When looking at NRS 175.381, it says nothing about a direct appeal.
Was a writ filed in this case on that count?
A writ of habeas corpus, Your Honor?
Yes.
No, it was not. No, Your Honor, that count was bound up when we went into the close of the state's case to go ahead and make the motion at that point. But as cited in the Evans case, it doesn't matter if this issue could have been brought to the court prior. It does not matter.
But let me get it straight. The actual motion made by the public defender's office was a motion for an advisory verdict?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And granted, for the record, it was mischaracterized as a directive verdict.
But and the defense rested?
The state had rested.
Has the defense rested, though?
At that time, the defense had not rested.
Then why would you make that motion at that time?
It was my understanding that advisory jury instruction should be made after the state has rested, Your Honor.
Where is that in the statute?
And I apologize, I'm not sure that there is a statute that clarifies when the position should actually be made, but since it's based on whether the state has proven their case, then it should be made after the state has rested.
Well, if I may interrupt, assuming for the moment that returning to the question about whether the court's action is procedural in nature or substantive in nature, regardless of when the motion is made or whether the state has presented all of its evidence, shouldn't we look at what the court said? In other words, what was the reason the court granted the relief that it did grant? The state argues here that this was a procedural dismissal as evidenced by the reason explained by the judge for granting the dismissal, that there was an incorrect statute. Isn't that what happened?
No, Your Honor, I still believe this was a substantive acquittal. When looking at what Judge Gates actually did, the state actually stood up and started arguing the evidence. And the state actually positioned it with, Judge, what the defense is basically saying is that we have not proven this case or this count by probable cause. That would call for a substantive acquittal. Judge Gates disagreed with him and still dismissed the count. So when you look at the record in the file, the evidence from the state was addressed. The state even narrowed defense's argument to probable cause based on evidence, and the judge still dismissed the count. So it is still a substantive acquittal. This was not one based on simply the language of the information. This was based on the idea that the state had not proven their case at the time they rested.
Okay. Well, let's assume for the moment that the court or the panel agrees with you on that point. Doesn't Lee and Evans suggest that, especially the sentence counsel quoted toward the end of his argument, that the double jeopardy clause is not implicated here?
the double jeopardy clause, it's our position the double jeopardy clause is implicated.
And why?
Well, to begin with, I don't believe Evans or Smith meant to overrule Combs. I think Combs is still good law. The United States Supreme Court, in citing to Nevada law, never once cited to Combs. It wasn't commanding your honors to revisit Combs. It was simply showing that the Nevada legislator is not powerless. And the Nevada legislator here is not powerless because they have corrected part of the issue by allowing for advisory jury instructions. They still have not addressed the issue when the judge goes against it. As far as the prejudice is concerned, when you're looking at specifically the Evans case, they hold that the policy that is that retrial filing and acquittal should upset a defendant's expectation of repose, compelling him to live in a continuing state of anxiety and insecurity. That prejudice still applies here. Judge Gates dismissed the count. Judge Gates would not allow that count to go to the jury at all. So for our petitioner's position, I'm sorry, our respondent's position, her repose was done at that moment. She should not have to live in a form of anxiety. That's a policy behind double jeopardy. And that's exactly what the Evans court searched, located for. It does not apply to an advisory jury instruction because there's a clear statute on hold there. And because the court doesn't say we're just going to dismiss it, the court says it should go to the jury. So that's why that policy does not apply there. But it does apply here.
So let me see if I understand your argument correctly. The first part of your argument is that notwithstanding the legislature's specific statement in its statute that the defense can seek an advisory instruction, because it does not specifically say that a judge can enter a directed verdict, the judge in Nevada has the power to do so.
No, I'm not saying the judge in Nevada necessarily has a power to enter a directed verdict. I'm conceding that what Judge Gates did was functionally wrong. There is no directed verdict in Nevada. However, as with every other state, when a directed verdict is implicated, double jeopardy does attach. So what my position is that looking at the statute at 175.381, if the legislator intended to also control directed verdicts even when the court doesn't have
the authority. Well, I'd like to explore this with you a moment.
Yes.
Because I was intrigued by your argument about the language of the statute. Why would you concede that if there's no prohibition against a directed verdict by a judge, that it's illegal for him to do what he did here?
I think I have to recognize in State v. Combs that the Nevada Supreme Court has already held that it's illegal.
Okay.
So, pursuant to State v. Combs, Your Honors did hold that the court does not have the ability to do so.
Is Combs right?
Yes. Combs is right, and Combs is still valid law, and I do not believe the Evans over Smith court ever meant to overturn Combs or to call Combs into question.
You're not asking us to revisit Combs.
Then. I am not. Okay. I think Combs is still standing law.
All right.
Any further questions? With that, I'll conclude my argument.
Well, you have plenty of time left. If
I was going to ask you if the case is reversed, is this an indictment or a criminal complaint?
This was a criminal complaint, Your Honor.
If the case is reversed, can you still file it? Challenge the sufficiency of the evidence?
Your Honor, my position on that would simply be, as far as the writ of habeas, as far as if the case was reversed, if Combs was reversed and we went down before today, my argument would be that if this case is reversed, so if Judge Gates' order was reversed,
right,
then my request would be for an advisory jury instruction.
During the trial?
During the trial, yes.
You would look at the transcript of the probable cause to see if there's any probable cause?
Probable cause as far as a preliminary hearing was held, or probable cause as far as the trial was held?
No, there's nothing to do with the trial. It has to do with the preliminary hearing. I know there's a 21-day rule.
And that was my concern, Your Honor.
But this would be void. What happened, if the case is reversed, it's void. And that means it can start over and not necessarily have a preliminary hearing, but at least challenge the evidence at the preliminary hearing.
Well, then I would absolutely, yes. If the 21 hearing, if I could overcome the 21-day rule, then I would absolutely be filing a writ of habeas corpus in district court.
What was the evidence that bothered Judge Gates so much? That what was presented that just that he went off half-cocked here?
Yeah, and what this state presented was the fact that Ms. Walker owned this car, however she had a lien on the car. That the car was essentially lit on fire, and that Ms. Walker continued to pay back the loan on the car. However, the state was still charging her with destruction of the vehicle against the owner's consent. So it really just focused on the terminology owner and the fact that the state didn't present any evidence that this was against Ms. Walker's consent.
What happened with the other counts?
The other counts was a hung jury, Your Honor. So a mistrial by hung jury. And there's still magazines are still out there at this point. We're just trailing Your Honor's decisions. So this case will go back to trial.
What a waste of judicial resources.
I can go, Your Honor.
Saying that to both sides. I have nothing further.
Anything, Judge Douglas? Okay, well, thank you for your argument. I didn't want to cut you off. Was there anything else you wanted to add?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And for the record, who's your colleague here?
Dan Jenkins, also of the public.
Okay, Dan. Thank you. All right, Mr. Cohen.
Your Honor, as far as the legislature goes, the legislature does provide for the district court to be able to enter an order of acquittal. It does so after the jury returns their verdict. That way there are no double jeopardy concerns. If the legislature wanted the defense to have the ability to get an order of acquittal beforehand, they would have provided that because they provided it afterwards.
What's the status of the other counts?
They're still out there. We're going to go to trial eventually on them.
Why eventually? Why didn't you go to trial after the hung jury?
The case was already appealed when I got to the office, and I'm moving forward with it at this point.
Is there a stay in effect as to that criminal trial?
We've just been continuously continuing it until...
But no stay from any judge or this court?
No.
What are the other counts? The ones that are still viable?
Insurance fraud, arson. Theft. And burning property with intent to defraud insurer. With respect to what the state argued, both the evidence and the pleading. Defense counsel is correct that the state said that there was probable cause in this case, but the state also said the count at issue specifically alleges that she set fire to the Dodge Magnum with the lien holder, road loans causing damages of $5,000 or more. So the state was hit with this notion in the middle of the trial, and it was ambiguous, like I said before, it was ambiguous, so the state argued both the pleading and the evidence because it wasn't sure what was being argued. As far as the defendant having anxiety about these charges hanging over, again, it's the defense that's responsible for their anxiety because they requested an order that's unlawful, basically. In Scott, which is this U.S. Supreme Court case that Combs is based on, the U.S. Supreme Court says the Double Jeopardy Clause, which guards against government oppression, does not relieve a defendant from the consequences of his voluntary choice. Defense in this case chose to make the motion that it made, and now it's trying to rely on the Double Jeopardy Clause to be relieved of that voluntary choice.
Counsel, you specifically are asking us to overrule Combs today.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
And if we do so, what's effect? Is it retroactive or prospective only?
I don't believe so, because I think that essentially in 2004, in the case of Smith v. Massachusetts, when the United States Supreme Court specifically cited Nevada law and stated that it indicated for all intents and purposes that Nevada has protected itself from this type of situation, I think Combs was bad law at that point. So what I'm requesting now is basically an order from the Nevada Supreme Court that embodies what the U.S. Supreme Court already said in Smith. I don't think I have anything else unless there are any more questions to conclude my argument.
I don't think so, Mr. Kovac. If your argument is concluded, we thank both counsel for their arguments today and their arguments in their briefs. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The matter will stand submitted. We'll be at ease.